Welcome to our deep dive, everybody. This time, we're going all the way back to ancient Israel.
Yeah, back to the world of the Bible. Well, not just the Bible, really.
Right. We're using archaeology and texts to uncover what daily life was actually like. Who's ready for some surprises?
Me. I think once we get past the, you know, the familiar stories, there's a lot of fascinating stuff waiting to be uncovered.
Okay. Let's jump right in. First up, social structures. Was the idea of a nuclear family as common back then? Like mom, dad, and kids?
Not exactly. Think more along the lines of the patrimonial household. It was a lot bigger. More like a mini community under one roof.
Really? So not just the immediate family?
Nope. You'd have extended family, servants, and even people who depended on the family. It was a much more complex network.
So like a built-in support system.
Yeah, you could say that. And, you know, the archaeology actually backs this up. When we excavate homes from that period, we often find layouts that reflect this model. You know, larger homes designed to accommodate a lot of people.
Wow. So the houses themselves are giving us clues. That's amazing.
Yeah.
But where does the king fit into this? I mean, he was at the top, right?
Ah, good question. You see, the biblical texts introduce this idea of humans as co-image bearers of the divine.
Meaning?
Well, it adds a whole other layer of complexity to the king's role.
So if the king is also an image bearer, was he more like a distant ruler or a father figure?
It's more like a both. That tension between those two roles is a theme that runs throughout the biblical narrative.
So it's about power, authority, and their relationship with the divine.
Yeah, all wrapped up in one. It's something to keep in mind.
Definitely. Okay, let's shift gears a bit. What would my everyday life be like if I was suddenly transported back to ancient Israel?
Let me put it this way. You'd wake up each morning and your main concerns would be food and water.
So pretty basic stuff.
Very basic. Securing those necessities would take up, most of your time.
No time for hobbies then, I guess.
You'd be surprised. Pottery, for example, was essential back then.
Yeah.
But yeah, getting food and water was the top priority.
Speaking of water, we talked about those cisterns.
Right. They collected rainwater, but like Jeremiah warned, that water could get pretty bad. Stagnant, unreliable.
Not the living water he talked about.
Exactly. Living water, fresh and flowing, that's what represented true sustenance. It's a powerful metaphor, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. You know, it's still relevant even today, especially with all the water scarcity issues.
Oh, absolutely. And speaking of sustenance, what would you say if I told you we can actually use archaeology to find out what they ate?
Seriously, I always thought that kind of information would be lost to time.
Not necessarily. There are techniques like microarchaeology and zooarchaeology. Basically, one focuses on the tiny stuff like seeds and pollen. The other looks at animal bones.
Fascinating. So what did they eat? Were they vegetarians?
Pretty diverse, actually. Both plants and animals. Common animal bones we find are from sheep, goats, cattle. Not much pig, though.
Ah, the kosher laws.
You got it. It's interesting, right, how we can connect those dots. And we can even trace the whole process of bread making.
Bread? Okay, now I'm intrigued. How did they go from grain to bread?
Okay, picture this. Plowing the fields, harvesting with sickles, and then using this heavy thing called a threshing sledge to separate the grain.
A threshing sledge. That sounds intense.
Oh, it was. Then came winnowing, tossing the grain in the air to let the wind separate the chaff, and finally grinding the grain into flour using grindstones.
Wow. Grindstones, we find those everywhere, right? Shows just how important bread was.
Absolutely. It was the staple food. And you know what else? They were super clever figuring out how to make sourdough long before yeast was a thing.
Ancient sourdough. I bet that was amazing. Anything else besides grains?
Oh, yeah. They were big on olives, and not just for eating. They used them for oil, too.
So olive oil for cooking, fuel, and even cosmetics.
Exactly. They were masters of multi-purpose. And the archaeological evidence shows they used these massive stone presses to extract the oil.
It's incredible how we can learn so much from everyday objects, isn't it?
It is. And speaking of those everyday objects, how about we talk about textiles next? Oh, textiles were a big part of life back then. And get this, some actual fabrics have been preserved. Imagine seeing clothing from thousands of years ago.
Wow, that would be incredible. What about the tools for making textiles? Any evidence of those?
Loom weights, for example. We find them at a lot of excavation sites. You know, those heavy things used to keep threads tight during weaving. And now, with microarchaeology, we can even study tiny textile fibers. It's really remarkable.
It's like we're zooming in on the past. So cool. Okay, what about building materials? Did they use a lot of wood?
Not really. Wood was pretty scarce in that environment. They mostly relied on stone. Think thick stone walls with maybe some wooden beams for support.
Makes sense. They had to adapt to what they had, right? So we've got pottery, textiles, and stone houses. What about metal?
Metalworking was definitely a thing. But you're not going to find a lot of metal objects just lying around, you know?
Because it was so valuable.
Exactly. They recycled and repurposed everything. Nothing went to waste.
Like ancient recycling. Smart. But if they were always recycling, how do we even know they worked with metal?
Good point. We actually find remnants of metalworking installations. Things like furnaces and crucibles. Proof that they were shaping and reshaping metal.
That's pretty impressive. Okay, let's talk about something a bit more abstract. Their religion. What can archaeology tell us about that?
That's where things get really fascinating, but also complicated. You have to distinguish between practices and beliefs. You know, archaeology can show us what they did, but it's harder to know what they actually believed.
So we can see the evidence of rituals, but not necessarily the thoughts behind them.
Exactly. And here's where it gets interesting. The Bible presents Yahweh as the one true God, demanding exclusive worship, right? But archaeology paints a more diverse picture. There's evidence of people worshiping other gods alongside Yahweh.
So were they polytheistic? Or was it more like blending different traditions?
Yeah.
It's a question that still sparks debate among scholars. And, you know, the Bible itself talks about this struggle for religious purity. Devotion to Yahweh alone was often portrayed as, like, a minority position.
So both the archaeology and the texts point to this tension between monotheism and a more diverse reality.
Exactly. It's so much more complex than just, you know, one simple belief system. It makes you wonder what it was like for individuals navigating those different beliefs and practices.
For sure. Okay, but how do archaeologists even identify these cult places? What are they looking for?
There are specific criteria they use, like icons or images of deities, inscriptions mentioning gods, and even patterns in the material culture.
So like what? Give me some example.
Let's say you find a bunch of figurines buried together, or maybe a lot of animal bones with incense burners. That could indicate a cult place.
Like an ancient crime scene, but for religion.
Haha, kind of. And we find all sorts of cult places, from little cult corners to much larger temples,
like the ones we read about in the Bible.
Yep. We've got evidence of temples at Arad, Dan, and Matzah. Even a big altar at Beersheba. And then there are those earlier sites from the Iron Age period that might have been connected to Israelite worship.
You mean like Mount Ebal?
Mount Ebal, yeah. There's definitely evidence of a shrine there, but there's still debate about when it was built and who was using it. And then there's the bull site, where they found a bull figurine that some scholars think might be connected to some of the worship practices mentioned in the Bible.
A bull. Why a bull?
Well, in Canaanite religion and many other religions around that time, the bull was a really important symbol associated with powerful deities. And you see that imagery in the Bible too, particularly in the Northern Kingdom.
So maybe some crossover between Israelite religion and other beliefs.
Maybe. Okay, but now the big question. What about the temple in Jerusalem? Any sign of that?
Yeah, the most famous one.
Well, that's the thing. We haven't found any physical remains of the first temple, you know, the one supposedly built by King Solomon. It's a big challenge for us.
So if we don't have archaeological evidence, how can we even begin to picture it? We just have to rely on the biblical descriptions.
That's one source. But those descriptions come from different points in time, and they often reflect changes made to the temple over the years. It's like trying to rebuild a house using blueprints from different eras, each with its own modifications.
Sounds confusing.
It can be. Mm-hmm. But we can use what's called comparative archaeology. We can look at other ancient temples to get a better idea.
Like borrowing ideas from the neighbors.
Exactly. For example, the temple at Andara has some features in common with descriptions of Solomon's temple.
Touches.
Well, both have a similar layout, a porch, main hall, and a holy of holies. They also have similar decorations, like cherubim and some plant designs.
Cherubim, those cute little angel babies.
Not exactly. In ancient times, they were fierce winged creatures, more like guardians than cute babies.
Okay, not what I pictured. So those other temples give us some clues about the look of Solomon's temple. But what about what happened inside those temples? Are there finds that show us the rituals?
There are some really cool finds that give us a glimpse into those practices. At Tel Dan, right next to an altar, they found what seems to be a temple altar kit.
A temple altar kit. That sounds interesting, like a little set of tools.
Yeah. It had a bronze bowl, a couple of shovels, and a pot with burned animal remains. And if you compare that to the Bible, you'll find descriptions of altar kits that mention similar items.
Wow, that's a perfect match.
Isn't it amazing? And it gets better. Some biblical lists even mention a fork in the kit. And guess what? In that same room at Tel Dan,
they found a fork.
Not a whole fork, but a long metal handle.
Wait a minute. A three-pronged fork with two prongs missing.
You got it. It's like the Bible is coming to life.
Amazing.
Okay,
what other exciting finds have they made? Anything that tells us about their beliefs?
Well, there are these things called Judahite pillar figurines, or JPFs. They're little figurines depicting women. And they've been found all over ancient Israel, even in Jerusalem.
What do those tell us?
That's the debate. Some think they represent the goddess Asherah. Others say they might have been prayer items or fertility charms. We're still figuring that out.
So more mysteries to solve.
Always. And to make things even more interesting, a lot of these figurines were found in Jerusalem, even during the time of kings like Hezekiah and Josiah, who are portrayed as super devout to Yahweh in the Bible.
So things weren't as clear-cut as we might think.
Nope, not at all. It shows just how complex and nuanced their religious beliefs were.
It's a good reminder that history is rarely black and white.
You got that right. Oh, and there's another tool we use to understand their beliefs. It's called onomastic evidence.
Onomastic evidence. That sounds complicated.
Don't worry, it just means dot names. By looking at the names people use, we can learn a lot.
Seriously? Just from their names?
A lot of ancient names were theophoric, meaning they included part of a god's name. Like Jonathan in Hebrew means Yahweh has given.
Ah, I get it. So you can see which gods were important to people.
Exactly. And we find names incorporating Yahweh, Baal, Hadad. It just reinforces that diversity of beliefs.
Like a puzzle with all these different pieces. Mm-hmm. Are there any inscriptions or artifacts that show this mix of beliefs more clearly?
Oh, yeah. Two inscriptions, one from Kerbet al-Kham and the other from Kintalat al-Jarud, mention Yahweh and his Asherah.
Yahweh and his Asherah. That's interesting. Does that mean they believed in multiple gods?
Well, that's what scholars are debating. Some see it as evidence that Asherah was, like, Yahweh's consort. Others think his Asherah could refer to maybe an object or symbol connected to her that was somehow included in Yahweh worship.
Like they were trying to blend different ideas together.
It does seem that way. And, you know, this mixing of traditions highlights an interesting difference between ancient Israelite religion and other religions.
What's different?
It's about the king. In lots of ancient cultures, the king was considered divine, right?
Like in Egypt, pharaohs were god kings.
Exactly. But in ancient Israel, Yahweh was the only true king. So the human king was accountable to a higher power.
So even though there was this blending of beliefs, they still believed that Yahweh was ultimately in charge.
That's the key idea. And that idea is woven throughout their history and literature. It's this reminder that power, no matter who holds it, is never absolute.
It's a powerful message and kind of timeless, don't you think?
Definitely. And it's one of the things that makes studying ancient Israel so fascinating. It connects to us even today.
Yeah, it makes you think. Okay, one more question for you. We've talked about how unique ancient Israelite religion was, but they weren't exactly isolated, were they? How did their beliefs compare to those of their neighbors?
Well, that's something scholars have been looking at for a long time, and it's pretty interesting. The Israelites had their own identity, for sure, but they were also definitely influenced by the cultures around them.
So they weren't totally unique?
Nope, not entirely. Archaeology shows us a lot of similarities, especially in the actual practices. Things like sacrifices, feasts, hymns, fancy temples with priests. You see those all over the ancient Near East.
So they were kind of sharing ideas, picking up things from each other.
Right. They were part of that whole cultural mix. And that makes it even more interesting, trying to figure out how they kept their own distinct identity within all that.
It's like they were taking those outside influences and making them their own. But what really set them apart? Was it just because they focused on Yahweh?
That's a big part of it. You see, Yahweh wasn't just another god to them. He was the God of Israel, the one they had this special agreement with, this covenant.
So it was about more than just, like, doing the rituals. It was about how they lived their lives.
Exactly. And that brings us back to that interesting point about kings and religion. In lots of other cultures, the king was like a god, right?
Yeah, like the pharaohs in Egypt.
Exactly. But in ancient Israel, it was different. Yahweh was the real king. And the human king, well, he had to answer to someone higher up.
So even if they had those mixed beliefs, they still had this core idea that Yahweh was in control.
Yeah. And that idea that Yahweh was the true king of Israel, it's all over their stories, their writings, their prophets. It's like a constant reminder that power isn't everything.
Wow. That's powerful. And it still makes sense today, doesn't it?
It really does. And that's what I love about studying ancient Israel. It's not just about the past. It's about how those ideas still matter today.
I have to say, this whole deep dive has been incredible. From houses and daily life to tools and religion, and even how archaeology and the Bible fit together, it's been like going back in time.
It's been amazing for me, too. It's always fascinating to see what we can learn from these little pieces of the past.
Yeah, it's those little details that make it real, like that altar kit they found or those mysterious figurines. They just spark your imagination, make you want to keep learning.
And that's what I hope you'll do. As you explore ancient Israel, just keep an open mind. Don't be afraid of the complicated stuff and let those ancient stories challenge you. Who knows what you'll discover?
There's a whole world waiting out there. What will your deep dive into ancient Israel reveal?